Hey everyone, this is Josh, host of the Urban Valor Podcast. Today's guest is Marine veteran Tyler Grogg. Tyler grew up in Worthington, Ohio. He was inspired to join the Marine Corps after watching Desert Storm and 9/11 on TV. He initially enlisted in communications, but ended up becoming an explosive ordnance disposal technician. Tyler took his skills to war in Afghanistan, where improvised explosive devices were prominent. In this episode, he walks us through several harrowing and fatal explosions that came with a heavy price, the loss of several of his brothers on the battlefield. Tyler leaves us with how his experience as an EOD tech affected his transition out of the Marine Corps and what he's doing to mitigate the trauma that goes unforgotten. If you enjoyed this episode, go give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment to help support our veterans. The bigger the community, the bigger the impact. If you'd like to contribute your story to Urban Valor or know anyone else who may, you can email me at josh@urbanvalor.com. Enjoy the show.
I'm Tyler Grogg. I was a United States Marine from 2004 to 2015. From 04 to 08, I was a computer network specialist. And from 08 till the end of my career in 2015, I was a explosive ordnance disposal technician, and I got out as a staff sergeant. So I was born and raised in Ohio. I grew up in a suburb of Columbus called Worthington. I think I had a pretty normal childhood, whatever normal is supposed to mean. My parents split up when I was about 5. You know, I played summer league baseball. Later on in life, I enjoyed, you know, music was always a huge part of my life. I have a younger sister and I have a half brother. So I am the oldest. And then I've got a couple step siblings sprinkled in there as well. So growing up, I played summer league baseball, and it was actually a dream of mine to play for the Chicago White Sox. I wanted to go to Ohio State University and play baseball for them, and then eventually hopefully get drafted by the White Sox. I was a big Frank Thomas fan growing up. Obviously, that did not pan out. I remember Desert Storm as a kid. I remember seeing it on the news, and I remember writing letters and drawing the little tanks, you know, shooting bad guy. Dear soldier, thanks for killing the bad people, or whatever kids write. And my neighbor who babysat me, her son was a Marine. And I had this wild imagination as a kid. I'm 37. I still have a wild imagination. You know, when I go to her house after school and she would watch me until my mom got home, I remember seeing his boot camp portrait on the mantle. And in my mind, I mean, I don't know what this guy did. I have no idea what he did. He, you know, he could have been a reservist motor T mechanic for all I know. But in my mind, he was literally the guy storming the beach and like waving the flag, like, let's go, we gotta go get him. And like, without even knowing this guy, it was like, wow, you know, he's a hero. And growing up, all my allowance money was spent at the surplus store. I remember me and my neighborhood friend who lived across the street, his dad was a construction worker. So there's all kinds of random wood and pipes and all kinds of stuff lying around the garage. And we actually made like PVC rifles, and we would like store. He had one of those 3-tier play sets with the cargo net and the big swirly slide. And it was so cool. And we would like storm it and like, you know, like battle plans. So I always just kind of fantasized that in my mind. And that obviously, you know, played into my adulthood because I wound up joining the military. I was definitely inspired to join the military, you know, partially by my childhood and you know, with the neighbor and seeing Desert Storm on TV and stuff like that. But I never envisioned it as a career at that age. You know, in middle school, I was definitely set on joining the Navy, but I got certified in scuba diving and I wanted to do anything underwater. I didn't care what it was. You know, I would have walked in that recruiting office and said, as long as you put me underwater, I'll scrub toilets underwater if that's a job. I just wanted to dive. So I never looked at it as like a long term, I could go beyond 4 years type thing. It was just a stepping stone to bigger and better things. And then 2000, you know, September 11th is really what pushed me to like, okay, you know, I was sophomore in high school and I remember that day very vividly. I was sitting in drama class, you know, rehearsing the upcoming plays and stuff. And Jackie Foreman came into the theater and she was like, hey, a plane just hit the World Trade Center and, the Mall of America is on fire. And I'm like, what? Like, what does that even mean? The high school came to a screeching halt that day. A bunch of us ran to the front office. We ran to the guidance counselor's office and we're watching this stuff unfold on TV. I knew what it meant. And it's like, we're under attack. And like, and now it's time to fight back. And so already having those seeds, fantasy buildups of like, you know, being that hero and stuff, it's like, okay, like, like you brought this shit to our doorstep. It's fucking go time. Like, let's do this. But again, being a sophomore in high school, I knew that was it. You know, I couldn't enlist right then and there, but I knew it was coming. Senior year, my friends are freaking out, you know, the SATs and college essays. And I'm like, I'm joining the military. So you know, I didn't have to worry about any of that. Recruiters get a lot of shit. And I will say I had a really good one. So again, I wanted to join the Navy. Beginning of senior year, after school, I drove down to the local recruiting stations. They had them in a strip mall. And I walked in the Navy recruiting office, and there's a chief sitting there. This fat dude sitting there, and he's just got his hands on his belly. And I walk in here, can I help you? And I was like, yeah, I want to join the Navy. And he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, you know, I'm really interested in, you know, anything underwater. You know, I don't know, you know, what kind of stuff do you have? And well, you know, and all of it came back to, he's like, you have to take your ASFAB. I don't even know what your scores are. Like, this dude just, he wasn't interested in signing me. I didn't get the impression that he wanted me to join the Navy. And this is 2004. So like, we're in Iraq, we're in Afghanistan. We're like, you would think it's like, I was a slam dunk for this dude. So I ended up walking out of the recruiting office, and I'm kind of starting to like, well, okay, that wasn't what I expected. And there's a, future Marine Corps recruiter standing there, and he's smoking, and he's in his, dress blues, and, you know, his freaking arms are out to here. He got tree trunks for biceps, and he just was an intimidating looking guy, very well built, uniform was like painted on. And he was just like, so you thinking about joining the Navy? And I was just this high school, you know, this timid high school kid. And, I was like, yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, like deathly afraid of this guy. And he's like, well, why don't you come in and talk to me? And I'm thinking like, I don't want to talk to you, but I'm too afraid to say no to you. So I walked into his office everything, the Marine Corps has a reputation, badasses, tough guys, which was not my reputation in high school at all. So I walk in, and I was there for, I don't know, a couple of hours, and I walked out, and I'm like, fuck yes, this is what I want to do. But same thing, I had to take the ASFAB. So, you know, fast forward, I took the ASFAB, and I remember I was super proud. He's like, you know, you'll probably get like a 50 or something like that. And then they circled my score. It was like a 77 was like my overall score. So I was like all proud. And he picks me up. He's like, how'd you do? And I was like, well, I did better than you thought. And he looks at it, and he's like, oh, shit. He's like, you're GT. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? He's like, what do you want to do? He's like, what can I do? He's like, you can do whatever you want. And I didn't know much about the Marine Corps beyond infantry. Again, kicking ass and taking names. So I kind of was just like, well, infantry. And he was like, I got these other quotas I got to fill. Let's steer you towards those. So he didn't undersell me by any means. He didn't lie. He was a great dude. Sergeant Warner. That was the last time I ran into him. Last time I you know, no idea what he's doing. But he sold me on comm, you know, and it was like, hey, you know, he told me what I needed to hear. It's like, you know, hey, you get a top secret clearance, which that sounds amazing. You know, you get to work with cutting edge technology. All right. That was probably a lie. But more importantly, it set me up for, he's like, hey, you know, computers, dude, it sets you up for a job in the future. And it was like, yeah, you know what? That makes sense to me. So I feel like my recruiting experience was really good. Boot camp. So the day of boot camp arrived. So I joined the delayed entry. All this transpired like relatively early in my senior year. Convinced my mom to sign the paperwork when I was 17, a month after my 18th birthday. I'm on Paris Island, on the yellow footprints, completely reevaluating my life. Like, what the and my recruiter, he set me up for success. Hey, do not wear your local Marine Corps recruiting t-shirt down there. So jeans, plain white t-shirt, generic sneakers, no fucking jewelry, don't get a tattoo prior. So they definitely set me up for success. But you get on this bus, it's the middle of the night, people are fucking yelling at you, and you get out of there, and you're like, what is going on? Like, you're fucking everything up. And it's all got a purpose, which I can see now. But at the time, I'm like, what the fuck did I sign up for? I just did my best to keep my head above water. I wasn't a guide. I wasn't a platoon. I literally was a middle of the pack kind of guy. Like, just don't. And I still got fucked with. Three names I'll never forget: Senior Drill Instructor Staff Sergeant Salisbury, Drill Instructor Sergeant Clark, and Kill Instructor Sergeant Miles. And Senior was cool. Sergeant Miles, we were his first platoon, and he was just a fucking tornado. I mean, he was our kill hat. He just like, you fucking looked at me wrong. Get on the quarterdeck. And you're like, God damn it. But Sergeant Clark, I was legitimately afraid of that guy. Like, he genuinely scared me. A couple different instances I remember. One of them was tail end of like third phase. We were practicing like our general orders and like how to stand posts and all that. And it's the middle of the night. And I'm out there and I'm walking back and forth and I got my rifle slung and I'm like, okay, like I know they're going to fuck with you. So just, you know, keep your head on a swivel, like try to catch them before they get up to you. Pretty sure the rules were like, you know, don't unsling your weapon or whatever. And so I'm doing my best to pay attention. And the next thing I know, this motherfucker's Sergeant Clark, this motherfucker's in my face and he was a McMap instructor and he loved that shit. So he's always carrying that little plastic McMap practice knife that they handed us, fucking always had it with him. And so he literally put the knife up to my throat and like instinctively I grabbed like, and I started to unsling my rifle and he's like, what the fuck are you going to do? And I'm like, nothing, sir. And he's like, you want to hit me? I'm like, no, sir. He's like, go ahead, fucking do it. And I'm like, oh shit. So then he, you know, asked me like, what's your first general order, whatever, some shit. And then he moved on. And come family day, come graduation day, he's like, fuck all of you. Fuck your families. I don't want to meet your girlfriend. I don't want to meet your mom. Don't try to ask me for pictures. And the last thing he ever said to us, he's like, if I ever see you in the fleet, he's like, don't fucking come up to me. He's like, because I'll knock you the fuck out. And I was like, oh, shit. I genuinely believe that, like today, if I walked into Target and I saw that dude standing there, I'm like, nope, fuck that shit. I'm not going to talk to that guy. I genuinely believe that he would still throat punch me to this day. MCT went really quick. We had a dude that was like on med hold. He was a Lance Corporal. So seeing a Lance Corporal for the first time was like, holy shit. But I do remember our guide left his, you know, got up in the middle of the night to piss or whatever, walked into the Port-a-John. He left his rifle in the Port-a-John. And the next morning, formation there, and he just came out. He was just pissed. And he was like, is anyone missing a rifle? You know, and then which of course is a stupid, fuck yeah. If you're standing here asking us a question, obviously someone's missing it. And he held it up and, you know, and then he threw it on the ground. He's like kicking mud on it. And it turns out it was the guides. And that motherfucker got honor grad. Like he graduated with honor grad. Anyone else, if I had done that, freaking they would have cut my throat, you know, and thrown me in the fucking forest. Went to comm school, became a computer networker, and then I actually got follow-on orders to the advanced school where I earned another MOS, learned a whole nother systems, and then basically the entirety of my class went to Okinawa. And I didn't even know that was an option. So they're just like, oh, hey, freaking U-12 people, you're going to Okinawa. And I'm like, the fuck is, where's that? Like, did you mean Oklahoma? So I show up and I try to embrace it. Yeah, it's a little nerve-wracking going to another country, you know, at 19 years old. But so I show up to my unit and it's like, I'm trying to fit in. I'm trying to get to know everybody. and again, mind you, in high school, I mean, you know, none of my friends did drugs. I didn't drugs. None of my friends drank. I didn't drink. You know, it was like a typical Friday night. It was like we all just went to the movies and went to eat Johnny Rockets afterwards. You know, like a little big crazy night for me in high school. So when I show up, my first introduction when we get to the barracks is, you know, we start knocking on doors and you know, door up. Hey, man, I'm Corporal Flynn. Do you want a chew high? Don't know what it is, but I'm not going to say no. So he hands it to me. It's just chew highs are these like, they're like, it was like some kind of alcoholic, like seltzer type drink in Okinawa. And so I'm like sitting there drinking it, literally never had alcohol prior. Well, I, you know, we did a little bit of underage drinking in comm school. We had a graduation party, but again, just trying not to be that bitch, trying to be that guy that's fitting in. Same thing next door. Hey, I'm Corporal Mock. What's up? You like Jack? And he's like, literally got this, you know, T handle of Jack Daniels. And I'm like, yeah, I love this stuff. And he's like, go ahead and take a swig. And I'm like, fuck my life. What are you doing? After like an hour, you know, of meeting everybody, I was just shithoused, like just fucking wasted. But, you know, the things you do to try to fit in. Once I pinned on Corporal, I got my blood stripes. And I remember it. So, it was a Friday night. I had, two corporals on each side, you know, and I got my arms around and they're holding me. And there's another one up there. And he's like, okay. He's like, are you ready? And luckily they let me get tipsy first. Thank God. So that took some of the edge off. But, you know, as it's like, okay, repeat after me, you know, start reading the Corporal's Creed. And as I'm reading, I'm getting, you know, I'm taking shots to the leg and I'm like, fuck. It was all said and done. And then it was just all hugs. And it's like, hey, welcome to the club. Congratulations. You know, we love you. And it was definitely one of those. It was a cool experience. Now, I couldn't run or barely walk for like the next 4 days. So PT was a pain in the ass. And that was a ritual that, you know, I can admit that I passed on, you know, as I continued to progress, you know, became the senior corporal, became a sergeant. I definitely, gave blood stripes to some of my guys. So that was a cool ritual that I liked. My unit in Oki was, so I was with 3rd FSSG. This was right before it got switched to MLG. So I was headquarters battalion, 3rd FSSG, and then there was a whole communications company. So I was attached to comm company. We had a radio platoon, we had a wire platoon, then we had our maintenance platoon and obviously our headquarters. So I got really lucky with that unit because our unit would fap out to other units and we would support missions. So I got super lucky. I could have gone to like the MLG level or, you know, a MEF level, and I would have been a help desk guy. And then I literally would have been sitting in a crypto vault, you know, doing crypto inventory, calling people on the phone to help them reset their password, just bullshit like that. I got fapped out to a lot of different units, and I actually got to go to a ton of places. I've been to Korea 3 times. I've been to Guam. I got fapped out and I did a humanitarian mission to Indonesia. They had a big earthquake in, it was like 2007-ish time frame. Very, very cool experience. I was, you know, a low man on the totem pole. It was a very, very staff NCO, very brass heavy mission because everybody was trying to get their humanitarian medal. Kind of like the Oki stack. You get your Korean defense, you get your humanitarian, you know, and you get a couple other little, you know, like sea service ribbons that you don't really get if you're not stateside. So that's what everybody was chasing. Oki was cool. It was a great time. It was a great first duty station because I was young and those were kind of like my party college years. Like I had to grow up. I had to get a lot of that immaturity out of the way as a young kid in Oki. And so when I was in Okinawa, they had the Libo card policy. I don't know if they still do it or if any, but so they had a red card and they had a gold card system. And it was up to your battalion commander. Most of them, I think, like the standing policy from the, you know, the big general in the sky was 90 days in Oki, you know, provided there's no bad behavior, no misconduct, then you automatically get a gold card. Our battalion commander was like, fuck no. He's like, as soon as you're a corporal, you can submit your package. And again, provided no disciplinary action or anything like that, good track record, you got your gold card. But if you were a lance corporal or below trying to get your gold card in our battalion, like you had to walk on water. Like you had to give Jesus a run for his money. Cool thing about our platoon, we all looked out for each other. It definitely lived up to its Marine Corps brotherhood hype. Like that was definitely a brotherhood and a fraternity, our platoon. It was, and even everyone in our company, we all looked out for each other. Being an underage kid with a red card, knowing that all my corporals are going to stay out because they got gold cards, it's like, fuck that shit. I'm staying out too. So we just, you know, tell that whoever was on duty, if it was 95% of the dudes were cool on duty. And it'd be like, hey man, like I'm going out and like, I'm going to sign out, but I'm going to call you around probably 11:30 and let you know whether or not I'm coming back on base. Like, do you mind signing me back in? Hey, no problem. I got you. Or they'd be like, hey man, I know for a fact that we're going to party all night. I'm going to get a hotel room and crash out in town. I'm not fucking coming back. Okay, cool. No problem. So, I mean, we just lived it up. And the best place to party on, so I was on Camp Kinzer, which was down south, and that was by the capital city of Naha. There's a strip club there called Broadway's. And Broadway's had the best alcohol package, period. 5,000 yen, all you could drink from 8 to midnight. 5,000 yen was about $40 back in those days, like $40, $45, something like that. So it's like $45 all you can drink. That's like literally 5 drinks over a 4-hour time period. Hell yeah. Of course a young Marine can crush that. So they would, you know, we'd all get there. We'd all sit down on the table and we'd order kamikazes. And, you know, as the waitress is putting them all in front of us, you literally slammed it and then you just held it back up. So by the time she got back around, she got done serving, she's collecting all of our empties. And it's like, all right, let's go. So slam about 3 kamikazes and then you get a drink to just kind of sip on the rest and just coast the rest of the night, you know, and do shots every now and again. And so it was just this rock star party lifestyle and it was cool. But there was nights where I got partied out and I was like, well, I have a red card. But I want to go back on base. And over by the main gate, there was this spot. There was this stretch of road. It was very poorly lit. And it run parallel to a canal. We'd be in the canal, then you'd climb up out of the canal, and that was the perfect place to hop the fence. There was no lights, there was no cameras, and I don't know if I should be admitting this, but I mean, I can't tell you how many times I hopped the fence in that section. You know, I cut my palms open, I've got scratches and shit on my stomach, I've tore my pants open, but I never got caught. The seawall, there was no barbed wire along the seawall, so Kinzer had, you know, nice, beautiful oceanfront property. And there was like maybe 200 yards of coral and like rocks, and not like pretty reefs, like fuck your feet up type reefs. And so there were times where we would walk to the end of the seawall. A couple times I swam back on base, like drunk as shit, swimming back on base because I just couldn't hang until 7 o'clock in the morning. So the gates would open up at 6 in the morning. You don't come back on base at 6 because then the guards are like, motherfucker, you were out all night. But you come back on 7, you can be like, yeah, you know, I left base at 6, grab a bite to eat, here I come back. You know, never mind the fact that I smell like alcohol. That was from the night before. There was one night I remember I was hurting. And I told Corporal Flynn, I was like, hey man, like, you know, do you want to go back on base? I basically was like, hey man, like, you need to go back on base because I just can't hang anymore and I don't want to get a hotel. And he's like, okay, well, what's your plan? And I was like, I got the perfect plan. He's like, we're going to call a honcho, which is a taxi. So we called taxis in Japan, or ogi. And I was like, we're going to call this honcho and we're going to stop here before the main gate. And then I'm going to get in the trunk. And then you go through and you show your gold card and then he'll just let me out. And at the time, this is the greatest idea ever. I was like, I'm a fucking genius. I'm a criminal mastermind. And what's crazy, this dude like literally understood everything I was saying. I don't know how, but it's like looking back, it's like he's probably done this before. So it worked. I got in the trunk and I hear him pulling up to the gate and my heart's pounding. I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm going to get caught. And nope. Drove my ass to the barracks, gave out, threw him a bunch of money and was like, hell yeah, dude. You know, again, at the time I thought I was a genius. I'm like, I'm the smartest man alive. But looking back, our gate guards were Okinawans, like very few, not a whole lot of military, police doing the gate guards. It was all locals. So taxi driver speaks Japanese. Gate guard speaks Japanese. So this taxi dude is probably, hey, I got some dumbass in my trunk, by the way. Just like, like he would be stupid not to, you know, and I'm sure that Okinawan, these old crusty guys, didn't even carry guns, making good money. It was just like, whatever. I don't give a fuck. Just get out of here. You know, I never wanted to draw attention. You know, it was like, hey, we're at the bar, but we had our usual hangout spots that we would go to. Broadway's ended up closing down. And then we found this new, it's called Camp Naha. And the owner of the bar was Pepper. It was this old Japanese dude. He was awesome. His assistant, Mama-san, and then he had a handful of bartenders, but he owned like 5 clubs, you know, and they each had kind of different themes spread out through the city. So we'd spend so much money there. That dude took care of us, you know, and I never wanted the vibe, you know, it was just about, hey, let's just have a good time. Let's just, you know, live it up. And we're not at work anymore. We're Marines. We're young. Let's do it. So it wasn't very often that you get somebody that we didn't know in, and anybody that walked into that bar looking to pick a fight with us was just in for trouble. Yes, there were a couple of fights, but, for the most part, I always tried to, and not just me, you know, like other people that I was with, we always tried to kind of just like, let's just squash that shit. Why do I need to get in a pissing match with you over, you know, whose dick is bigger? Let's just go grab a beer together and enjoy the fact that we're both Marines. I got orders cut to EOD school. Backing up to a Korea mention, I was in Korea a couple times. So I was in Korea on a mission or on a training op, and I was a Lance Corporal at the time. The cool thing about being a computer dude is once the computers are set up and everything's ran and everybody's good and everyone's happy, you kind of just sit back and twiddle your thumbs. Attached to 9th ESB, I was fapped out to 9th ESB, who has an EOD company attached to them. And Gunny came up to me. He's like, hey, Grog. He's like, you know, like, the network's set up, everything's running smoothly, you know, EOD's looking for volunteers to go to the range. And I'm like, what's that? And he's like, I don't really know. I just know that they do something with explosives. And I was like, okay, whatever. But you're telling me I don't have to be here for the rest of the day? Got it. Let's do this. So we go out to the range. It was me, Corporal Troy, and a couple other people from the unit were out there. And they were doing kind of like a test range. You know, we had C4, we had thermites, and they were explaining how, you know, hey, this is time fuse, this is how it works. This is deck cord. This is how it works. You know, this is C4. But the cool thing about it and what immediately hooked me, they were using water bottles and like IV bags, and they were like slapping sheet explosive on the back of an IV bag. And they were using that to like blow open doors and like, you know, like completely splice open ammo cans. And so it looked cool, but it was like, hey, why are you using water? Like, why are you putting 3 strands this long of this explosive rope into a water bottle? Like, what is that doing for you? And then they're explaining, like, you know, these are procedures that we're practicing to use overseas. You know, this is how you breach a door safely. Like, you know, or this is how, if you're trying to gain access to a vehicle that you think a bomb is in, or a box that you think has something you think has an IED, use water charges because the water's now traveling at the speed of the explosive and it hits everything and it'll literally rip it open, but it'll tamp it. So if there is something, if there is an IED in a box, you can effectively, you could disrupt it, you could diffuse it, you know, or you could at least expose it without the risk of setting it off. And it just, I mean, it just warped my mind. I'm like, what the fuck? And I left thinking that day. I was like, I'm like, so you guys get paid money by the United States government to blow shit up. And then you get to come out here and you get to be like, I wonder what would happen if I did this with this explosive. And I'm like, where the fuck do I sign up? But I was a Lance Corporal at the time, and you had to be a senior corporal, promotion eligible to sergeant. There's all first class PFT. There was no CFT at the time. GT of 110. There's a couple other, you know, obviously within height, weight standards, all that good stuff. No disciplinary action, no negative remarks, pros and cons, you know, above 4.7s or whatever. I don't know. But they had all this criteria and you had to screen. I went on the MEW as a comm guy. I ran at EOD again. I started rubbing elbows with them. And then I ended up screening. Once we got off the MEW, I called up Gunny Carnivale and I said, hey, it's that sergeant that's bugging you all the time. I'm like, I want to screen for EOD. I'm ready to do this. He emailed me the paperwork. I got my package ready. You know, he told me the criteria and I was like, he's like, all right, you know, you're going to come up here. You're going to run a PFT. We're going to put you in the bomb suit right afterwards. You're going to have to carry a 155 around. You're going to do a bunch of stuff. And it's like a 30 minute from start to finish in the bomb suit. Like you gotta hack it. We gotta prove that you're not claustrophobic. We gotta prove that you can function in the bomb suit. So obviously there's no way for me to practice that. So that was what I was most nervous about. And the day of screening, I get up to, they were up at Camp Hansen. So I get up to Camp Hansen. I'm in PT gear. I'm ready to go, you know, do my pull-ups. You know, I think I knocked out like 15 or something. So I was like, all right, cool. Sitting pretty good. Got my 100 crunches. And I'm like, all right, cool. Don't fuck up the run. And then you got that, boom, check in the box. Because at any point in time, if you fail to meet that requirement, you know, it's like, hey, you're done. That's it. Go home. You failed the, you know, not failed the PFT, but if you didn't get a first class, hey, go home. You can try again in a couple months if we like you. So I'm running, I'm monitoring my time, I'm doing good. And then all of a sudden, Colors comes on. And I'm like, hey, fuck, I'm running a PFT. And in Okinawa, Colors isn't just normal Colors. You know, they play Colors and they play the American national anthem and then they play the Japanese national anthem. And it's like a fucking 30 minute adventure. So I'm running and then I hear, hey, Marine, it's fucking Colors. And I'm running. I'm like, yeah, I'm running a PFT. He's like, I don't give a fuck. You need to stop. And I'm like, no, I'm running a PFT. He's like, motherfucker, who the fuck are you? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, God damn it. So I stop and I'm at attention. And the whole time I'm just counting 1, 2, 3. Okay. How many seconds am I losing? Where do I got to pick it up? Blah, blah, blah. Gunny Carnivale is there. And he's like, it's like, what the fuck happened? He's looking at his watch and I'm still running. And I'm like, there was a guy and he yelled at me. He's like, did you tell me to run a PFT? I'm like, yeah, he had a lot of brass on his collar. I don't know. And I just kept running. He's like, you better pick it up, motherfucker. So I'm like, God damn it. Like literally thinking this guy just fucked my chances to be an EOD tech. So I got done. I made it fucking barely, but I made it. I think I had like maybe 20 seconds to spare. And I'm like, you know, like dry heaving and trying not to puke. And Gunny was like, it's like, how long is Colors? And I was like, I don't know. He's like, well, I think it's about 3.5 minutes. And I'm like, okay, sounds good. So he knocked 3.5 minutes off my runtime, did the bomb suit test. Nothing was bad. But by the end of the day, I left and I knew that I had been accepted. You know, I had to come back one more day to kind of just do some administrative shit. But the moment that I was just like, fuck yes, I did it. Like fire was just ignited. And I was like, fuck yes, can't wait to do this. And I think the Marine Corps does it right. We're older, we're more mature. You know, my stupid party days were behind me. And, you know, I was more focused. You know, I knew what I was getting into. I knew that, hey, this is like, you're going to go over there and you're going to fucking defuse IEDs. This is your fucking job. Whereas some of these 18-year-old kids that I went to school with, they just didn't fucking get it. They weren't taking it seriously. Fast forward going to EOD school, all four branches go together. We go to Naval School. It's run by the Navy. It's in it's near Eglin Air Force Base in Destin, Fort Walton Beach, Florida area. And yeah, we just had some of these 18-year-old Army fucks in our classes. And when I was going through EOD school, reality set in. There's a dude that I OJT'd with at a third company in Okinawa, Jesse Cottle. Great guy. Cool guy. He ended up losing both his legs in, I think it was Iraq. Jesse, don't hate me. I can't remember. I think it was Iraq. Could have been Afghanistan, but again, double amputee. And I remember, Rob Sampson, another great dude, another EOD tech, you know, he's the one that told me, he's like, hey man, you remember Jesse? I'm like, yeah, he's like, he lost his legs. And I'm like, fuck, like, yeah, this is real. So that definitely put me on my on a different mindset and really made me grind and knuckle down and study, you know. And then you got these little fucking 18-year-old kids that are gaffing off study hall. And I remember there's one day I was fucking pissed. Fucking Walkinshaw. I remember that kid. Really wanted him to wash out, but he was just too smart. He wasn't studying. He wasn't participating in the group. And he's like, hey, Walkinshaw, like, you need to pay attention, bro. I already know all this. Like, oh, okay, well, then what's this fuse? Yeah, gotcha, bitch. Pay the fuck attention. And he didn't listen because I was Marine. He's Army. You know, who the fuck am I? Even though I'm a sergeant. Our class leader was this Army reservist. He was an old dude. I mean, he was literally like in his like mid-30s. And I fucking yoked Walkinshaw. I said, get the fuck outside. And I went to the class leader. I was like, I'm gonna go yoke this kid up. And he's like, do you want my help? I'm like, nope. And then the other two Marines in my class, Holmberg and Cheney, we all walked outside and I just fucking started ripping into this kid. And I'm like, fuck you. If you don't want to be here, I'm like, get the fuck out. Like, this is real, motherfucker. You know? And I'm like, well, you're going to be downrange someday. Fucking your legs are going to get blown off and you wish you would have paid attention in school, you know? And I'm just fucking ripping into this kid again, because, you know, all this shit was like, it's like, yeah, people I know are now getting hurt and fucking dying. That was kind of like my one, like, and I never had any problems with that kid afterwards. We didn't have any problems with anybody in the class afterwards, you know, because word very quickly spread. Don't fuck with these guys. So I graduated EOD school in September of 09. And the way that we did it is we had graduation chunks. So it was basically everyone graduating in within like a 2-month block, lump all the Marines together. They sort you by highest to lowest GPA. And then they, you know, if there's 10 guys, they request 10 sets of orders. Like my orders group, there were 10 guys. So we got 10 sets of orders and I was number 4. I was really pushing for Camp Pendleton because I was dating a chick at the time. We started sort of dating when I was in Okinawa. We met because I was dating her friend at the time and she was dating another Marine. Doesn't matter. She was a nursing student and she lived out in California. To me at the time, you know, San Diego and Los Angeles were like, you know, like literally twin cities. I didn't realize how far apart they actually are, but she lived up near Los Angeles. So for Pendleton, it's like, awesome. You know, I'll go to Pendleton. We'll keep dating. We'll fall in love. We'll have 12 babies and our life will be great. She flew out and she stayed with me over spring break. And then she actually stayed with me over her entire summer break too. So I'm at school for like 8 hours a day, plus another 2 hours for study hall. And then I come home and I'm just fucking exhausted from being in the training area and all this stuff. She fucking hung with me. You know, she packed my lunch. She did my laundry. Orders came. There were 2 spots to Camp Pendleton, like 1 to Miramar, 2 to Camp Lejeune, and then the rest were all Oki. And I was like, fuck this shit. I just came from Oki. I am not going back, especially when, you know, I got this awesome chick. First 2 orders to go immediately were Pendleton because everybody loves Pendleton. And then I was like, all right, cool. I'm trying to think like, all right, who's ahead of me in the orders group? Like, I don't think he's going to want to go to a wing unit. Like, you know, people tend to go to company. They want to go to company. First company at Pendleton, second company at Lejeune. And then God forbid, you know, there's nothing else left. Third company in Okinawa. So I'm like, okay, cool. You know, wing unit. It's not as exciting as company, but at least it'll get me out to California. And this motherfucker at the last minute decided he wanted to go to Miramar. So then that left me with Camp Lejeune. So I got orders to second company, 8th ESB at Camp Lejeune. And I remember going to the parking lot and making that phone call and I was not a happy camper. I was called her up and I told her, hey, I got orders to Lejeune. You know, she starts crying and I'm like fucking heartbroken. And I was like, it's okay. We can make this work. And we were dating for a little bit. We continued to date for a little bit. And it was Christmas of 09, Christmas of 2009 or New Year's. There's sometime around there. I was home on leave. I was visiting my dad. I was staying in my sister's room at the time. And I remember calling her. She was upset. I don't remember what we were texting about, but I remember calling her and I was just, you know, she's crying on the phone. I was like, look, I'm like, I know this is tough. I'm like, I promise we'll figure out a way. I'm like, you know, I love you. I want to be with you, you know? And I flat out told her on the phone that night. I was like, and I want to get married. You know, I was like, how does that sound? And I just remember her going, you know, but you could tell she was happy, but she was still fighting back those tears. Well, it wasn't the right time. So we ended up breaking up. The timing wasn't just right. So then at that point it was like, all right, let me knuckle down. Let me start focusing because as soon as I showed up at company, I would drop to the special training unit. So, you know, we would build training IEDs. Like my first day there, I'm building bra bombs, you know, for some unit to go train with. And then a couple months after that, as we were beefing up our numbers, they started picking and choosing who was going to go to platoon. I ended up getting dropped to 4th platoon. They're like, all right, like, we're going to Sangin, Afghanistan. Everyone's like, where the fuck's that? So we started doing our intel reports, and we're like, fuck. You know, started pulling all the reports of, because first company guys were out there. They were, you know, so we're looking at their reports, looking at what they're doing for IEDs, and we're like, all right, fuck, like, game on. You know, and every Friday was our intel briefings. You know, CAS reports would come in. Hey, you know, fucking so-and-so lost their legs. This is how. So-and-so died. This is how. And it was like, just like, okay. So we spent beginning of 2010, almost a full year, just nonstop fucking balls to the walls training.
Boom goes the murder hole.
March of 2011, boots on the ground, you know, in the blink of an eye. Went from training, you know, and then all the flights, you know, flew up to Ireland. Then we flew into Kyrgyzstan. We were in Kyrgyzstan for 3 or 4 days for an in-brief. Then we flew into Afghanistan. We did the whole, you know, C-130, you know, you're going like this and the combat spiral in, which was dope. And then we did all our in-briefing there. And then the next thing I know, I'm at FOB Jackson in Sangin, and our convoy's there to pick us up and take us. And we actually stopped in the bazaar. So I hop out of the back of the truck and I'm just looking around and I'm like, fuck, I'm in Afghanistan. You know, and the crazy thing was, it wasn't scared. And I'm not trying to say that to sound like a tough guy, because there are definitely times where I was scared shitless, but we had done so much training, and we had actually done lane training, in Mount Town, where we had Middle Eastern role players. I think they were Iraqis, you know, that were speaking the language, and, you know, they had the sound effects, and the training was so good that it's just like, that's what it felt like. It just felt like training. And that's how it went for about the first month and a half, you know. And within 3 hours of being boots on the ground, I was stationed with 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, Bravo Company. And our main FOB was FOB Inkerman. And then we had PB Transformers, PB Fires, PB Vegas, and I can't remember the other one. And then each PB was a platoon with weapons platoon being at Inkerman. But then the first 3 hours of being on Inkerman, we got our first IED call. And of course, being the new team in town, you know, the outgoing team, they're like, hey, fucking, you guys are the sheriffs now. This is your fucking IED. Dave, my team leader, and I, we busted out our tools, and it was literally, it was routine from start to finish. No hesitations, no nothing. It was just like, okay, you know, did our shit, gathered our evidence, popped the main charge, and I was like, oh. Yeah. I thought I should feel more. Like, why am I not more excited about this? Or why am I not more scared? Like, I was just very monotone about it. It was just a weird feeling. First kind of realization, and I eventually figured out why everything was so routine. I mean, again, the first month and a half we were there was just sun up to sundown, not a whole lot of energy. A lot of IEDs, but not a lot of gunfights. It's because they were harvesting the poppy. So they're scoring it, they're getting their gum, they're refining it, they're turning it to opium. And then it was like a switch just fucking clicked. You know, one night went to bed, farmers are smiling at you, hey, boy, America, we love you. And the next morning, fuck you, motherfuckers, you know, and it was game on. And that was because all that heroin, all that opium had been sold. They got their money, they bought their fucking RPGs, they bought their AKs, they got all their fucking HME, and it was fucking game on.
Little 3-liter jug. I'm gonna push right around the corner right there. About 2 minutes 45 seconds. We got a little 3-liter jugs, about 10 pounds of explosives there. No battery pack, no pressure plate. So should be a nice little boom.
The first what the fuck moment that hit home was it was in April. It was April 24th of 2011. Dude that I knew from school, David Day, got the call over the radio that he was killed. He was a recon Marine prior. So he shows up to EOD school. He's a twin pin. He's got his bubble, his scuba bubble, and he's got his gold jump wings. So, which to any Marine is like, damn, that's sexy. You must be high speed, right? So at this time, this is the era where they're starting to set up MARSOC. You know, they're starting to develop the Marine Special Operations community. And literally, if you were, they needed EOD techs. And really the only criteria was we needed combat experience. And so here you have a brand new dude. He's already scuba qualified. He's already jump qualified. And now he's a triple threat with his EOD badge. Fuck yeah, we want to recruit that guy. I've always been so angry at the Marine Corps for allowing him to go MARSOC because he wasn't ready. Like, yeah, he was a great trigger puller. You know, he's a great jumper, but you know, talking with him, like, hey man, why did you not just stick with recon? He didn't want to do that anymore. He didn't want to kick doors, kick in doors and shoot people in the face. He wanted to blow shit up. And, which I can respect. That's what I wanted to do. That's all I wanted to do is blow shit up. So I just got fucking angry when I found out that he was killed. And I took it very personally. The last time I saw him was, about 6 months prior. We were still back home. We were on a range sweep at Camp Lejeune. So he just showed up. I don't know why. And, you know, it was like, oh shit, what's up, bro? And, like, hey man, you're going to come, we're going to go sweep this range and look for some dud fired ordnance and we're going to blow some stuff up and have a good day. And he's like, hey, you know, can I tag along with you? He's like, you know, we don't do any of this, you know, over at MARSOC. And it's like, fuck yeah. So we're sitting there chit chatting and, hey man, that's a, you know, this is an 81 millimeter mortar. This is how this fuse works. And he's just like, whoa. I'm like, so what are you doing? And so it was a good conversation, but, so that sucked. And then our gunfights picked up. IEDs were nonstop from sunup to sundown. Dave and I were dismounted with the grunts. And we would basically convoy to one patrol base. We'd get escorted out there. And then basically it was just a game of, you know, pass the EOD text to whatever platoon needs them. So we're doing maneuvers under fire. We're laying down suppressive fire. I was a glorified grunt. Luckily, prior part of my training include, I was lucky enough to go to the infantry squad leader's course. That counted as my sergeant PME. But I made it very clear to all these grunts when they would come through and talk to us. I'm like, look, I get that I'm a sergeant, but hey, Lance Corporal, you know more about being a grunt. So if I'm fucking up, you need to tell me. And that one, I think that comment went a long way. First holy shit moment was in mid-May. I don't remember the date. We're on a battalion clearing op, and
dude, I don't know if I've turned my camera around in time.
Hey, we need EOD. We found an IED. Cool. Show up at the compound. So it's this walls, you know, maybe 8 feet high. Inside there, there's a little garden. You got some animal stalls, and then you've got this thin walkway, and then there's a concrete structure behind us. So he walks us down this path to the main charge, and it's an old metal British casing. So it's an illumination casing. Candle pops out. You're left with this nice steel container, perfect for packing HME. And now you got a bunch of frag you can throw everywhere. So he walks it up and we look at it. It's me, Dave, the engineer. We look at it. We're like, yep, that's the main charge. And then we walk back. Dave starts looking in the flower field. I double check the inside, you know, just seeing what I could find for evidence wise. And then I post up near this concrete pillar. He goes back down and he busts out his metal detector and he starts sweeping and he's like, holy shit. I'm like, what? He's like, well, I found the pressure plate. Well, turns out main charge was here. Pressure plate was here. So now the engineer found it, walked back, missed the pressure plate twice. Then you have three motherfuckers that walk down and walk back and we all missed the pressure plate. We're like, well, this is, goddamn, this is a fucking miracle, right? He's looking. He couldn't find a battery pack. So we're like, well, that's fucking sketch. And he decides, he's like, all right, I'm going to hook my rope up to it. And I'm going to pull this plate out of the ground. And I'm like, that's not a good idea, dude. Counter IED 101, attack the battery, attack the main charge. Do not fucking touch the switch, period. So you got electricity that's flowing and all it's waiting is for you to step on it and complete that circuit. And now when we rip the pressure plate out, here's why you don't attack the pressure plate. When you disrupt it, you have two bare wires that are just dangling in the wind, just waiting to touch. So he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be very careful. And, you know, he goes down range, and by down range, I mean, this dude's like 10 feet away from me, and he hooks the rope up. We get back, get behind the pillar. And this is a hefty pillar. Fucking pops it out. He's look around the corner. Fuck. Pulled the plate. So we literally have a worst case scenario possibility. We're like, okay, awesome. There's electricity flowing and there's two random wires somewhere in that fucking dirt mound. Hey man, this is not a good idea. Like, let's just fucking pop the main charge and let's get the fuck out of here. Like, what are we doing? No, it's fine. I got it. Okay, he's the fucking team leader. What am I supposed to do? Freaking next thing I know, I felt like I got hit by a fucking train. I got thrown against this concrete pillar. My head's on fire. My fucking bell's ringing. Everything's blurry. There's dust everywhere. And the first words out of my mouth are, what the fuck? And then reality sets in. What just happened? Like, well, that's an IED explosion. That motherfucker was right there. Like, I was right there. Fucking Dave was right there. And all this shit happened in the blink of an eye. It was like slow motion, but it was also like sped up at the same. It was a really weird feeling. Dave was more than just my team leader. Like, I knew him from the Mew. he's part of the reason that I'm in the EOD program to begin with. So he's not just a team leader. He's a fucking brother, you know, not to mention that, you know, we did all this training together. I hung out with him and his family. The last time I saw him, he's kneeling down. And I don't know the relation between the main charge. So I literally, in my mind, I'm like, fuck, he's dead. He's my best friend is dead. I just watched my best friend die. And more scary was the fact that, you know, we get up close and personal with these things. So our fucking heads and our faces are right there. And I'm like, not only is my best friend dead, but he's fucking decapitated. And now I got to go find his fucking head. Thank God that wasn't the case. So I run out. I'm like, fucking Dave. And he's like, I'm okay. Fucking grace of God, the main charge was offset enough in his position that pretty much everything went over his head. And his face was bloody, and you know, his head was on fire too. I was fucking furious. I started fucking chain smoking, and I'm just fucking pissed. Because I fucking knew. That was on me. I fucking knew that he shouldn't have done that. And I should have stopped him from doing that. You know, I was a fucking EOD tech too. And he was a great team leader. He was training me to be a team leader. You know, he was getting ready to pass the reins off. So that could have been my moment. To be like, no, fuck you, bro. And then like, I love you, but fuck you. I'm going to pop that main charge. We're not dying today. I still kind of hold on to that. Like, I wish I could have changed that moment. Then later that night, we button up in a compound and first sergeant comes over and he's big, hey, I heard you guys had a fun day. And he cracks some fucking wise ass comment. And he's like, all right, I thought you guys were supposed to defuse them, not set them off. And he's thinking, you know, and Dave's like, And I wanted to fucking hit him so bad. I wanted to lay his ass out. Be like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, he could have died today. I could have fucking died today. Fuck you. Don't make some kind of smart ass comment like that. And this was he was an admin first sergeant attached to a grunt unit. So he was a fucking card. He was a combat action. He was chasing his combat action ribbon and he was chasing his Bronze Star. And he got both of them, but fucked everyone else, right? And that was the first of what would be four enemy explosions. My second and my third was hands down the worst day that I had ever been there. Early morning, we got a tip that the previous night over the cameras, they had watched some asshole put an IED in the ground, got the grid coordinates. Hey, we're going to go out there. We're going to take care of it. Like, because now we actively hunt for IEDs. That's a fucking great idea. Just go walk around Afghanistan looking for them. So off in the distance, we hear an explosion. We're like, well, we're the only EOD team out here. It came from that direction. I know Alpha Company's over in that direction. So maybe it was Alpha Company. And as we're walking back to the FOB, comes over the net, hey, you need to go to do a post-blast, which I hated hearing post-blast. Post-blast usually meant picking up pieces of people. It's just fucking terrible. I stopped counting. After a while, I stopped counting IEDs, how many IEDs. You know, I stopped measuring the size of my balls by how many IEDs I diffused, and I started measuring it by how many post-blasts I did, and I didn't want to do any. So we hear there's a mass casualty incident. I'm like, fuck, all right, like, let's go. We got to go. So we get there, and I'm fucking running up, and I see half a squad just lined up on this berm. Dudes with patches over their eyes. You know, Sergeant Keitlinger's arm is all wrapped up. And here come two other dudes with a stretcher. And there's a Lance Corporal he was a Lance Corporal engineer. His legs were hanging off the stretcher. Well, what was left of his legs were hanging off the stretcher. From the knee down, it was just shredded. Skin, meat, bone was missing. And the dude was white. He was Xerox paper white. I'd never seen anybody look like that before. This wasn't my first, you know, this wasn't the first time I dealt with death or even a dead body. Not even by a long shot. This was June. And I knew the kid. He's actually from a town that was a little podunk town. It was about 15 minutes from the podunk town that my dad lived in. So I knew exactly where the fuck he was from. And what had happened was they were going out on patrol, come across the bridge over a canal, near side IED, far side IED. He missed the near side. He stepped on the far side. And as, you know, the squad was going up to render first aid, triggered the near side. So now they got to deal with that. So now they pump the fucking brakes. And so we get there. We look at the posts, you know, we look at the blast seats. We do our thing. We find the evidence. We find the battery. We find pieces of the jug. We, you know, bag everything up. Now it's time to start doing body recovery, serialized inventory recovery, and all that good stuff. Dave banks off to the right. I bank off to the left, and I grab another engineer I knew, Michael Boucher. Hey man, can you sweep for me? You know, so I can focus on looking for this. And you know, these engineers, they're fucking crushing it. I love those guys. They were excellent at finding IEDs. So he's in front of me. He's not more than a foot or two in front of me. And we're bullshitting, like, you know, I'm trying I'm trying to be that level-headed sergeant. I'm trying to be that inspiration, that motivation, like, you know, because all these engineers came from the same unit, you know, freaking Boucher and this other kid, they're thick as thieves, you know, and I fucking know that. So of course he's pissed. You know, he's ready to just fucking let loose on anybody that he can get his hands on any Afghani he can get his hands on. Got a garbage bag and I, you know, start collecting pieces and I bend down. I see a piece of skin and I pick it up and it's got like little leg hairs on it. And then boom, everything goes blank. Fucking lights out. And my memory picks back up. I'm sitting next to Boucher. His flak's off. His left leg from the knee down is gone. His right leg from the knee, the meat is gone on his right leg, but his bone is still there. And then there's this chunk of what I can only assume was his Achilles just hanging off. Corman's right there. Corman's like, you know, throws me a bandage. Hey, bandage up his leg. The fuck you? There's no leg. What do you want me to bandage up? And he's like, just, you know, wrap around it, try to protect the dirt. And I was like, all right. So I fucking shove his Achilles in there and I start fucking wrapping him up. And this kid was in shock. Because he was in shock because he had no fucking idea what was going on. He looked down his legs and he's like, well, that sucks. And he's like, but on the plus side, he's like, at least I get to go home and have a beer. I couldn't help but kind of laugh at that. It was a typical Boucher. And then I look behind me and I see our company commander, our captain, the infantry company commander, not mine. And he's lying in a ditch and he's got his hand up like this and his eyes are closed. And he's got like, kind of like, almost look like rigor mortis set in. And I'm thinking, when the fuck did he get here? He wasn't out here. Like, why is he fucking dead? And everything went in slow motion. I see company guns, you know, he's holding his hand. He ended up losing his trigger finger that day. A couple other dudes are like, you know, and then there's a whole wall of grunts. There's some fucking Afghani asshole that has come screaming up on a motorbike. They did the escalation of force. He ignored it, schwacked that guy. But I'm not piecing this together. I'm like, I'm missing something. Something's fucking missing. And I would go the rest of my deployment and about another 6 months afterwards without ever fucking figuring out what's going on until I'm standing in an awards formation. And they're reading this citation. And they're like, you know, this award presented to Sergeant Grog for outstanding on this day, you know, this. And I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, this isn't me. I wasn't there. I don't even know what you're talking about. So after, I'm like, Dave, like, what the fuck do you remember about that mask has in June? And I'm like, why the fuck does this citation say all this shit? And he's like, because you did all that. I'm like, what? What had happened was, last thing I see, piece of skin. Boom, IED hit. Boucher steps on an IED. He loses his legs, and they called it walking wounded is what it is. I don't remember shit. But this is where all that training paid off because allegedly, and again, this is other people saying it. These are other people's words that went into witness statements that went into official award write-ups. So I'm assuming that it's all true. I put the tourniquets on Boucher and I gave him the morphine and I stripped him down and I did all this shit. And I don't remember any of it. As I'm working on Boucher, Captain Frank is running up and he stepped on another IED. So we had actually missed one, which I feel like a piece of shit. One fucking job to do, right? So he stepped on that and he actually didn't die. He only ended up losing a foot. And then I heard he made a full recovery, did a couple more years in the Marine Corps. But it just was one of those days where, so we had four fucking IED strikes. A whole platoon became combat ineffective. I got hit twice. And that's the day that they ended up writing me up for an award and for a Purple Heart and everything. And that was the defining moment where I stopped giving a fuck about my life because I didn't expect to leave at that point, at least not with both my legs intact. And what the trend that we were seeing though is it was more likely that you were going to lose a leg than actually die. We had very few people actually get killed, but dudes losing legs left and right. So I was like, hey, you know, I'll trade a leg for a free ticket home. Fast forward another week and Gunny Pate was killed. And you really want to talk about a fucking morale blow. I mean, this one's still to this day. Here we are, what, 2011, 12 years. So it'll be his 13 year anniversary this coming June. And I still have a shitty day. I wake up that day and I'm automatically in a bad mood. And then it doesn't click until I look down, you know, look down at my bracelet, look down at my watch. I'm like, oh, that's why I'm in a shitty mood. It's because it's Gunny Pate Day. He was unlike any other Marine I ever met in my life. Cocky, arrogant, but he could back it all up. And he got whatever he wanted. He just had this smooth swagger to him. And he just, he was a fucking hero. He's a fucking legend in the EOD community. Multiple Bronze Star recipient, multiple combat tours, most of the major battles from, you know, fucking pick a major battle from the Iraq-Afghanistan conflict, and he was there. He taught us everything we know. He taught me how to be faster. He taught me how to be smarter. He taught me how to be better. He just pushed, and he fucking pushed hard. I got to know him really well in my off time as well. He'd come over to the appointment. He'd fucking literally call me like 11 o'clock at night, like, hey, bitch, what are you doing? I'm like, fucking sleeping. What do you think I'm doing? And there was a bar right down the road from my apartment called Riptides. And he's like, hey, man, let's go to Riptides. I don't want to go to Riptides. He's like, well, I'm in the parking lot. God damn it. All right, let's go. And we wind up staying out till like 2 or 3 in the morning. And it's like, bro, like we got a fucking PT. And he's like, I don't know, man. I'm your platoon sergeant. Like, it's cool, man. Like, so some days he'd be shitty and he'd wake up and be like, yeah, fuck it. We'll go in a little bit. I got you. Don't worry about it. And other days he'd be like, all right, bitch, let's go. And I'm like, I'm still drunk. He's like, yeah, whatever. Fuck, let's go. I remember what I was doing. We just got back from an IED call, came over the radio. Hey, one of your guys got hurt. Dave was like, I'll go investigate it. And he comes back out and he's like, hey, EJ's dead. I'm like, no. No, that's impossible. Like, he's too good. He's too fucking smart. How the fuck are you going to outsmart this guy? He's done it all. He's seen it all. And I just fucking, I fell to the ground, chain smoking. I started fucking crying in front of all these grunts. I didn't give a fuck. It hurt. It hurt a lot. Had a wife, had kids. Definitely, I think that also kind of played into a lot of my survivor's guilt that would eventually come down the road. And, you know, sadly, he wouldn't be the last one that we lost. We ended up losing two more. Dan Patron, we lost him, Sergeant Dan Patron. We lost him in August. I mean, he was a great guy. He was the most relaxed guy. He actually gave me my nickname, my call sign, and my nickname was T-Pain. And I asked him about it one time. I said, hey, Dan, why T-Pain? Like, you don't even like rap music, you know, because T-Pain was real big back then. And he's like, well, you know, T because your first name's Tyler and Pain just because it sounds badass. And I'm like, I can roll with that. And I gave him the nickname Extreme because this motherfucker, he loved motocross. He had a couple other nicknames, but that, you know, that's what I called him. A couple of us started calling him that. He was a motocross. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to get out. He always had a Monster in his hand because he was trying to get sponsored by Monster and he just wanted to ride dirt bikes. That's all he wanted to do. And he broke his foot. He like broke his arm. He broke his leg. He broke his foot. He fractured everything. He had to be, if I'm not mistaken, he had to be ordered. Like, you're not allowed to get on a fucking motorcycle anymore. Stop wrecking because you got to go to fucking deploy. So the last time I saw him was when I was actually attached to Alpha Company. This is my fourth and final explosion. I was attached to another team leader at the time. We were doing this round robin to give us some R&R because everybody from my platoon has similar stories to mine. We got fucked up. From our platoon, two killed, I don't know, three or four that lost limbs. And literally, I'm pretty sure the rest of the platoon was Purple Heart recipients, except for maybe like two people. So I was with Alpha Company. It was a shitty day. We actually saw the guy putting the IED and they started a gun run on him. We had a Cobra and a Huey above head and they were doing gun runs and they were trying to get him. And this motherfucker is just like, it's like, and we're watching this shit on the G-Boss and he's like running around and we're like taking bets on it. And he stops and he starts holding his gut and we're like, okay, cool. You know, they hit him, but why is he not dead? And then he looks around the corner and then you see the screen go black. Well, I guess the pilots got sick and tired of trying to shoot him with their cannon. So they just launched a Hellfire and smoked him with a Hellfire. So now we got to go do body recovery. Now we got to deal with this IED in the ground. So we get out there and we can see it. We caught him in the act. So we knew where it was, but it's this alleyway. And these are like 20-foot walls. And there was two breach sites on the right side. So somebody had been here before and blown a hole in the wall on two separate places. So put the ladder up. Brad's like, hey, I'm going to put the ladder up and I'm going to climb up and I'm going to, you know, see what's on the other side, make sure there's nobody hiding there. So he's like, oh shit, there's command wire. Okay. Well, this guy was planning on hiding in the building and he was going to try to ambush us. So we blow open the door just to make sure there's no booby traps. And, he peels left. I peel right. You know, I go tape up the ends of the wire to make sure that nothing can accidentally happen. I secure the battery, throw in an evidence bag, and then Brad just starts going, oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck. And I'm like, what? And he's like, I saw a DFC, which is just an improvised claymore mine. So they were using paint cans and they were packing them with nuts and bolts. And I've even seen sprockets like this big packed in them. So it was on a remote control. And so he's like, hey, I found an RC device. I'm like, okay, well, what'd you do? He's like, I don't know. I just started cutting wires. What? I'm like, okay, well, where's the remote? And he's like, oh, I got it in my hand. So I sweep over to him and we're like, we breathe this sigh of relief and we're sitting there and we're kind of joking about it. We're kind of laughing about it. And then we walk up this mound and we're standing there and it was like, okay, hey man, there's that previous asshole IED. Hey, here's the DFC. I'm like, okay, cool. What do you want to do? He's like, hey, let's attach a rope to this. We'll pull it. We'll stack everything up. We'll blow it and we'll get out of here. And I was like, okay, cool, man. High five. And then I took a half step left and that all too familiar feeling that I've already felt two times before, I felt that boom and it fucking threw me down that mound. Brad's screaming. And I look at him, left leg, knee down, just that all too, I'm like, fuck, this is pathetic that this is routine. Left leg gone, right leg is just completely mangled. Blood is just gushing down his leg. And I fucking ripped his tourniquet. I'm cranking on it. Blood wouldn't fucking stop. And so I grab another one. I put another one on. And I'm retching. And this dude's, and he's fucking screaming. He's in pain. And I'm like, fuck, like, I'm sorry. I'm cranking. And finally, blood stops. And I go, same thing on the other leg. Fucking blood would not stop. Corman comes up and he's like, hey man, he's just shattered his pelvis. I'm like, fuck. So I straddle him, I grab his belt, and I'm like, brother, I'm sorry, this is gonna fucking hurt. And we lift him up, and again, he's just screaming. And I'm like, can we give him some morphine? Doc handed us, stick morphine in his shoulder, and it doesn't even touch it, doesn't even touch his pain. Didn't even fucking feel it. And I'm like, hey, like, we need to give him more. And he's like, I can't. I'm like, fuck you, yes, you can. Luckily, Doc didn't listen. I mean, what do I know? I don't know how much you can give him. And so we got him on the medevac, and he survived. So that night, it just again, feeling just shit. Like, what the fuck? This is my fourth explosion. So I get back to the hooch, and I'm just losing my mind. I'm throwing my fucking Kevlar. I'm throwing my vest. I'm just pissed. I'm like, why the fuck does this keep happening to me? Can you please just knock my fucking leg off? Stop toying with me. Take my goddamn leg. I don't care anymore. You know, I'll figure it out. I'll figure out how to walk. It's fine. Like, I'm done with this whole you're not losing limbs bullshit. You know, because all too many of my friends and all too many of these grunts are losing shit left and right around me. And it felt like the fucking Grim Reaper was toying with me, you know? So Dan came in as a team leader to replace Brad. And we're sitting out there that night. We're sitting out in front of our hooch and we're smoking and we're just, we didn't say shit. And we're just looking up at the sky, watching the stars. And he was just like, he's like, I'm scared. And I was like, me too. And it felt good because he's done this before. He's deployed. I looked up to him because he's been here before. This is my first combat deployment. And if this motherfucker's scared, then now it's okay for me to, like, it validated me feeling scared. And so the next morning, his teammate comes back. I go back with Dave and my team. And the last thing I said to him was like, hey, man, I was like, I love you. And I'm glad I said that. I'm glad that those are my last words. But it would be a couple weeks later in August. He would be working on an IED that was, I believe it was an RPG, rocket propelled grenade that was booby trapped. And everything, when it comes to post-boss, everything is speculation. So we can take an educated guess as to what went wrong. It was booby trapped and it got him. Just hands down, some of the worst times of my life. Well, deployment for me actually ended a little early. Our company commander, me and Jason, he pulled us out. He ordered us back to Leatherneck, Camp Leatherneck, which was the main Marine base in Afghanistan for medical evaluation. So I had four concussions, you know, four documented concussions from enemy explosions, not to mention the fact that there's all too many times when we actually won and we're trying to blow up IEDs, you know, we just weren't as far as we needed to be. Micro concussions, I guess, if that's a thing. So he's like, hey, you guys need to get your head scanned. And I didn't want to go. Nobody gave a fuck about me my first explosion. Nobody gave a fuck about me my second or third. So why the hell are you pulling me now? Like, the finish line is right there. Let me finish what the fuck I started with my guys. And I was very angry about this. And he said, no, it's only for a couple days. Hey man, Dave was, hey man, you need to go. All right, fine. I'll go get my head scanned. I'll get my head scanned. Doctor's like, yeah, you're not going back. Company commander, yeah, you're not going back. the fuck does that mean? What do you mean? What do you want me to do? I just sat on Camp Leatherneck while everyone else is out in the fight, while dudes are fucking, you know, getting hurt and every fucking day just praying to God that nothing else happened. You know, please nobody else die. Please nobody else lose limbs. We need to finish strong. There's about a month and a half left. And by this time, started therapy, started, you know, they're toying around with medications. And they started to kind of start to diagnose me with PTSD and TBI at this time. Put me on some sleep meds. I was on Ambien for a little bit. And when it worked, I would sleep for like 16 hours. And when it didn't work, I was literally hallucinating. That didn't work. And I was put on a couple other medications. And by the end of this, I was like, look, I'm not playing guinea pig anymore. Fuck these medications. So we came home in November of 2011. We went to Germany. We did this whole decompression, 2 weeks in Germany. And it was cool seeing the sights. It was cool being able to drink a beer again and have a good meal. But, I didn't want to be there. I wanted to go home. I wanted to be home because prior to our deployment, you know, I met a chick and we were already talking about getting married when I got back. And I wanted to start this fantasy life that I had built up in my head, because up to this point, pretty much everybody else in my platoon was married with multiple children. So, and of course, you know, everything is all, it's all shiny and awesome from the outside. And like, so here I am, you know, the single dude. Nobody, you know, no little kids waiting there for daddy or my hero. No fucking wife with the sign that says, you know, that's my husband. I'm so proud of you. And I wanted that. That's what I fucking wanted. Wind up eloping and getting married, and immediately I neglected my mental health. I neglected my physical health. And it was just like, no, I'm going to focus on the one thing that I want that I thought would make me whole again, was starting a family. Track the cycles, and we did all that, you know, like, oh, it's the right temperature, it's the right time, the stars are aligned, the fucking Mercury's in retrograde, let's go for it. And actually I knew it was a fight. My wife at the time, you know, she had reproductive issues. We knew it was going to be a struggle, but it actually wasn't. Didn't take us long, got pregnant, and I was like, okay, now I can justify my survivor's guilt. This is why I survived, is because now I get to throw my energy into being a dad. And I get to build what I had set back out to as a child. Like, have a great family, fucking be a man, hold your family together. She ended up having a miscarriage. There was a heartbeat, and that was an amazing moment. Definitely a memory, you know, here that I can still hear that sound, and it was awesome. And then it just wasn't there. And that was fucking torture. Cause now, the one thing I wanted was taken. So now everything is just amplified. And it's been, she would have been 12. So 12 years later, it still fucking hurts. So now my ex, this became a weapon. So she was not a good, our marriage was terrible. She had her own issues. She had her own mental health issues. She was physically abusive, verbally abusive. And then now she's trying to grieve this process. I tried to be a supportive husband. My dad is an OBGYN. So he's obviously the first guy I talked to. Like, you know, he said, son, he's like, you know how many women I have to tell to have a miscarriage on a daily basis? He's like, anywhere between a dozen and two dozen. From a doctor standpoint, it's a common occurrence. Leaning on my mom, you know, she opened up to me. She's like, hey, it's from a woman's standpoint, it sucks. It hurts. And so I'm trying to step up and be that comforting husband, but then I don't get to grieve. She used all that against me. She would blame me. She said, you know, this is your fault. The reason you caused my miscarriage, you know, with your PTSD and with all your fucking problems, you're the reason we don't have a child right now. And we're both convinced it would have been a girl. And every ounce of me wanted to be like, well, fuck you. Like, look at all the medications you're taking. The fact that she's got eating disorders and you don't even fucking take care of yourself. Never crossed that line. Never did. But in my mind, I just, all this anger and just built and built and built and built. I got angry, but I never fucking did anything to her. I would fight back verbally a little bit, but most of the time I tried to just separate myself from this situation. And now all of this is going on between 2011 and March of 2013, while I got promoted to staff sergeant, while I'm trying to be a fucking team leader, I'm trying to go back and accomplish a milestone in my career. I wanted to be a team leader in combat. For me, that was the pinnacle of my EOD career. Get my senior badge, be a fucking team leader. boom, check in the box. I'm dealing with these home issues. And on the outside, you know, picture perfect Facebook, you know, we're laughing, we're giggling, happiest couple in the whole fucking world. And nobody knew. There was one night I remember, I don't remember how the fight started. It always started over dumb shit. And then it very quickly escalated. And I go outside and I'm just trying to leave. It's like, I get the fuck out of the house. I'm trying to get in my truck and I'm trying to drive away. She rips my keys. She jumps on my back, rips my keys out of my hands. She wouldn't let me. Trying to get her off, but also trying not to. She was a buck, 110 soaking wet with fucking rocks in her pocket, you know, small, tiny girl. If I just accidentally, you know, she would bruise easily is the point I'm getting at. So I'm trying to avoid that because she fucking knows. She was married to a Marine prior. She fucking knows how to call my command. She's threatened all this shit before. She's threatened to destroy my career. So I can't leave any marks. So the only thing I can do, I take my shirt off, fucking start sprinting. So I'm running down the fucking street barefoot in jeans and she's fucking yelling and she can't keep up. And I had my phone in my pocket and then same routine, every argument to text messages start coming in. Well, fuck you. You know, fuck you. I'm going to destroy this. I'm going to destroy this. I'm going to sell your shit. You know, I'm calling your command. I'm calling the cops. Just anything she could do to get a rise out of me and to fucking antagonize me. And she fucking sent pictures. She got her Glock and she put her Glock in her mouth and sent me pictures. She's like, I'm going to fucking kill myself and it's going to be your fault. She's like, I'm going to leave a note so that they fucking know that it's your fault. How the fuck am I supposed to deal with that while I'm trying to manage my PTSD, while I'm trying to manage my survivor's guilt? And then I'm trying to hide all this shit from my fucking command too. I don't want people to know that I have problems. Suck it up, buttercup, and keep moving forward. So everything literally just started to spiral. And it was leading up to that. It was the tail end of 2012, leading into 2013, that I started to slip. I was no longer a golden boy. I started to become a troublemaker. 2013 deployment, really nothing overly exciting again. You know, we were drawing down. So we were closing down PBs, or IEDs or gunfights. Really nothing exciting other than the fact that I'm trying to fix my marriage. And right before deployment, you know, we kind of reconciled, kind of had this, you know, come to moment. And it was like, okay, like this is, what the fuck are we doing? We need to figure this shit out. We need to be adults. She started hanging out with another buddy's wife and they were having marital problems too. So I was able to kind of lean on him because he opened up to me about his issues. So I'm like, fuck, okay, thank God we have this in common. It's not just me. So they were thinking divorce and those two became like a power couple, you know, my wife and his wife. And they were out partying and they were out, you know, it was just one of the, like trying to call, yo, bitch, I'm in Afghanistan right now. Pick up the fucking phone so I can talk to you for my sanity. Phones went unanswered, emails went unanswered. And then got the inevitable Dear Johnny letter. She, hey, you need to call me. Okay. So I call her up. Hey, so I cheated on you. What? When? I don't know. Month ago? Month and a half ago? I'm like, okay, well, why are you waiting to tell me this now? Well, I'm pregnant. What the fuck? I'm in Afghanistan. This bitch is crazy. So I'm pissed. I'm pissed. I'm hurt. Like, how the fuck could you? But I can't do anything. And I know what she's capable of. So I had to put on an Oscar award winning show. Hey, you know what? It's okay. I love you. I forgive you. Let's raise this kid together. When in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, don't fucking drain my bank accounts. Don't fucking sell my house. Don't destroy my fucking life. Like, I'm thinking that's what she's going to do. So she ended up having another miscarriage. And then as we're getting, like, I'm literally a couple weeks away from coming home. Hey, I don't feel comfortable with you coming back and living in the house. She just changed into a very different person over that. So I agree. My other buddy was having marital issues. His wife moved out. So he let me move in. So I stayed with him for about a month and a half. Eventually got to the point where he kind of had to very politely be like, look, bro, I can't fix my marriage when you're living at my house. And I was like, I agree. So I moved back in. We slept in different bedrooms. You know, the fighting stopped. We stopped fighting. We stopped talking to each other. There was nothing. There was just nothing left. And I really knew that fucking marriage was over when I got back in 2013, I took my mental health, my physical health way, way more seriously. And I did started off doing a whole bunch of tests. And one of them was, you know, like how are my swimmers? How's my sperm count? And it was bad. It wasn't good, you know. And so the doctor gave me advice. I quit smoking, quit drinking. I focused way more better. And I started to try to rebuild because I still wanted that. And despite all her flaws, I was still fixated on this. You cannot get divorced. This is the commitment you made. You got to fucking stick it out, bro. I went back and I got reevaluated, and I got the call from the doctor, and he said, "Hey man, just, you know, congratulations, you know, whatever you're doing, it's working." He's like, "Everything looks great." He's like, "You know, your count looks phenomenal. You should have no issues getting pregnant." And I was happy. So I sent her, "Hey, I just got the results." And he's, you know, he says, "I got Navy SEALs swimming around down there." And her response was a, "Congratulations. Hopefully you can go get some other random chick pregnant." Not us, random chick. So that's what I meant to her. So what I was after all this shit was, yeah, go fuck some rando and get her pregnant. That's what she wanted for me. Awesome. Kept slipping, kept making mistakes. Shit just kept fucking piling up. I started seeing a doctor, she was an ologist, psychiatrist, psychologist. I don't know which one. Her claim to fame was that she worked with the high risk or high functioning, or I can't remember how she put it. She worked with MARSOC guys, and she worked with EOD tech guys, high kinetic guys, you know, some infantry guys too. She knew how to handle those. She knew how to treat those. Pill pusher. That's all she was. She's a glorified pill pusher. Her immediate, I'm just unloading everything onto her. And basically it was just like, okay, well, we're going to start you off on this medication at this dosage. I don't want to do that. It's not what I want. But who the fuck am I? I'm Staff Sergeant Nobody. Hey, just shut your mouth, blow shit up, and take these fucking pills, because I'm the goddamn naval doctor, not you. Was the mentality and the attitude. She didn't actually say that to me. But so all right, I started taking these antidepressants, and I was just lethargic. I started gaining weight. I had noticed I would go to the gym, but I would just stand there. You know, pick up to a couple bicep curls, and I'm like, well, I don't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to watch TV. All I wanted to go home, and I wanted to lie in bed. That's all I wanted to do. Not even because I was tired, but I became a zombie. And it took me a while to realize it. And again, it affected my work. It affected my attitude. It affected, like I said, my weight, which in the Marine Corps, fucking, as soon as you're overweight, you're a shitbag. Plain and simple. Nobody gives a fuck why. They don't ask why. And I told her, I was like, hey, I need to get off this medication. I can't do this anymore. And so, nope, just keep taking, you just got to power through, just keep taking it. You got to let it build up in your system. I don't want to let it build up in my system. So I stopped, and I stopped seeing her altogether. So I started seeing this family counselor. He was a Army infantry, rose to the rank of first sergeant. He told a couple stories. So it's like, great, here's another combat vet. Like, I feel like I can offload my combat problems onto you because you get it, which was hard to do with this other doctor, you know, female, non-combat, MOS, naval doctor. What the fuck does she know about combat and me? How can she relate to me? So I started seeing this guy for me personally, and he's like, hey, I also do marriage counseling. All right, hey, let's give this a try. After the first session, she left. She's like, well, that was a fucking joke. Okay, got it. So all these fucking red flags. You think I would have figured it out, but kept trying. So I'm doing my best. I'm doing everything I can to just. But I'm also still hiding so much from my command. And that kind of brings me all the combat, all the years, all this marital stuff had been going on. This miscarriage still weighed heavily on me. Everything, you know, she's still abusive, blah, blah, blah. And everything kind of culminated to this one fucking moment that would literally change my life in a 180 direction. Ex had gone to, or my wife at the time, she had gone back to Washington to take care of her grandma. And I will say the only thing she was ever good at, she had panic attacks. She had anxiety, which she was on medication for. So the one good thing I will say is she was always very good at helping me work through my panic attacks. She knew what to say, and she was very calming, and she, hey, just breathe, watch me, blah, blah. But she wasn't there this time. So I started having this panic attack, and my chest got tight. Everything's just closing in around me. And I thought I was going to die. I'm like, I'm going to fucking die. My lungs are going to stop working, and nobody's going to be here. It was a weekend, so I'm going to lie here bloated and dead before anybody even figures it out. So again, she was prescription anxiety medication. So my solution was, let me go grab a Xanax in her medicine cabinet. Took a 1 milligram fast acting Xanax. I was having so many memory issues at the time as part of my TBI, as part of the multiple concussions, as part of the way my brain functioned. It was like my short-term memory was terrible. I'd forget shit all the time. So I blocked the incident from my memory. You know, fast forward a couple of days, we had a briefing. We had a new general check in, and he was addressing the whole battalion. He was addressing everybody one battalion at a time at the base theater. And I'm sitting in the base theater and listening to this guy talk, and I get a text from one of our admin sergeants. Hey, are you going to be able to make this piss test today? And I took it as an opportunity to, I'm tired of sitting here listening to this guy talk about shit that I don't care about. So yeah, hey man, I'm on my way. I'm out. So take the piss test. I don't know, week, 2 weeks, however long goes by. Master Guns Carnivale. The name may sound familiar because Gunny Carnivale was the staff NCYC on the Mew. He's the guy who put me in the EOD program. He was also my mentor at EOD school. He is now one of our master guns at company. I look up to him, respect him, don't want to disappoint him. Hey, I just got a call from NCIS. We got to go see them. And my first words out of my mouth was, Master Guns, I don't smoke weed. That's just what I thought. I don't smoke weed. And he was like, okay, you know, no big deal. He's like, are you on any prescriptions? Yeah, I'm on prescriptions. I'm on some antidepressants and some other stuff. And he's like, okay, you know, do we know about him? I'm like, I don't know. He's like, whatever, let's go figure it out. So go down to NCIS, and I'm trying to remain calm. I'm trying to freak out, trying to think of what I do. And I sit in front of this NCIS agent, and this dude fucking plays me like a fiddle. He's my best buddy. Hey man, how's it going? What do you remember? And I'm like, look, dude, I don't know why I'm here. I'm like, I never did drugs in high school. I've never done drugs in my life. I don't even know anybody. I don't even know where to get weed. I just was fixated on this weed thing. And he's like, hey, do you know what alprazolam is? I'm like, yeah. Like, that's Xanax. And he's like, well, how do you know that? I'm like, well, my wife takes it. And he's like, do you take it? And I was like, no. I'm like, that's not one of the medications I'm prescribed. And he's like, you want to tell me why you found Xanax in your urine? Like, I don't know. And he's like, you know, he's like, look, man, he's like, you know, I'm here. I'm here for you. We can figure this out. You know, I just need you to be honest. And I'm like, and then it clicked. I'm like, that's right. I remember. So I told him, and then I just started offloading. I'm like, oh, and I'm just word vomiting this NCIS agent. And I'm telling him, and I'm like, oh, thank God, this is the defining moment. Now I can start to unload all this emotional baggage I've been carrying around. And hey, all right, Austin, thank you so much. We appreciate you. I'm gonna go to bat for you. I'm gonna talk to your battalion commander. What he really was saying was, fuck you, bro. As soon as I get back to company, about an hour after we got there, I go back. I was filling a admin build at the time. I was working in the front office because we had collateral duties. I can't remember who comes in. Somebody comes in the admin office. Hey, you need to clean out your locker and you need to go home and you're not allowed back in the building. Why? Where's this coming from? You're under investigation. What? Okay. So grab my shit. I fucking leave. And I get a phone call from Chris Lucas. Hey man, what happened? So I tell him the story and he's like, well, that's not what word's going around company. I'm like, what the fuck's going around company? He said, hey, major client addressed the whole company and you're not allowed back on premises and we're not allowed to have contact with you. And the rumors are flying that you're dealing drugs. What the fuck? I've known Chris. I knew him from school. We deployed together twice. He's still one of my best friends. I talked to him not that long ago. He didn't believe it for one second. He took my side. But those were the fucking rumors that started about me. So I sat at home for a couple days. Then they found a spot at battalion headquarters for me. They put me in like some safety staff NCO bullshit billet. And I had no choice. I had to own it. I had to own what I did. And I did. I owned up to it to the NCIS agent. I checked in. I told the lieutenant that was in charge of me and the captain that was in charge of me. I'm like, you know what? I'm glad this fucking came to light. Cause now here's my problems on a fucking platter. Now I can start to fix them one at a time. Only problem was nobody wanted to fucking help me. Period. So I got a lawyer and we started this review board process. and I had, there was a major, a master guns, and a captain, all from the company, but nobody knew me personally. So it was an unbiased board. And I had an actual lawyer, and then there was an enlisted gunny that was some kind of paralegal. And this, it wasn't a trial, but I don't know what the official title was. So this trial started. And then they paraded people up to, you know, my, hey, we need to know, who would say good things on your behalf. So I submitted a very short list of names of people that I thought would go to bat for me. And then same thing, the prosecution did the same thing. And Chris got up there and he said, you know, great things. And, he was honest. He didn't try to sugarcoat shit, but, they focused a lot on the combat experiences, you know, like how PTSD and anxiety could have led to this. And then, and I'll never forget, my platoon commander got up, and company first sergeant got up there at the time. Master sergeant got up there, and he didn't really know me, but he still said, he's like, you know what? He's like, this kid is slipping, but I know he's trying. You know, I know he means well. You know, we need to, turning our back on him is wrong. This is essentially what he alluded to. Prayed my platoon commander up there and asked him the same, you know, same set of questions. Like, hey, do you, and the kind of the final question, do you think this Marine deserves a second chance? Minimal hesitation. No. Fucking gut punch. Fuck you, dude. You don't even know me. We didn't fucking deploy together. You're a fucking boot chief. You're a boot fucking warrant officer dropping to our fucking platoon. You know, this, I fucking, motherfucker didn't even know I got a Purple Heart. How the fuck do you not know one of your guys is combat injured? You know, and he's literally just fucking slandering me up there. And I'm like, fuck you, bitch. And despite all of that, I still was at least the bigger man. And at the end of the day, I looked at it, I said, hey, I shook his hand. I said, I appreciate you. I appreciate you coming out here. I appreciate you being here today. The goal, what I wanted to finish my contract. I had about 8 months left, and that would have brought me to the end of that contract. I just wanted to finish that out so I could plan what the fuck I was going to do with my life next. And the board said, hey, we're going to let you finish out your contract, and we're going to give you a general under honorable discharge. I'm like, okay, awesome. I got about 6 months to figure out what I was going to do with my life. A couple weeks later, I get a phone call. Hey, the general says, get the fuck out of the Marine Corps. And, but at least you get to keep your discharge. So come to find out, that motherfucker could not touch my discharge because the board voted to have that discharge. He was not allowed to downgrade it. All he could do was upgrade it, which obviously he wasn't going to do. Whole little, I'm the new fucking sheriff in town. He set an example. Fuck this guy. Get the fuck out of my Marine Corps. I had 2 fucking weeks to figure out what the fuck I was going to do with my life. And everything was just, what the fuck? And I'm still with my wife at the time, my ex at the time, and I'm calling her and I let her know what's going on. And I said, hey, like, I'm getting the fucking boot. And she started crying. I said, hey, it'll be okay. And she's like, where am I getting my health insurance? I don't know why I expected anything else from her. I don't know why the fuck I even told her, why the fuck I expected anything else from her. But it's like, you're fucking worried about you. Fuck you. What about me? Like, do you not understand the potential impact that this is going to have on me trying to get a fucking job? My DD-214 said drug abuse, discharged fucking drug abuse. And anyone takes one fucking employer takes one look at that. What are they going to think? Like, oh, this dude's smoking weed, snorting coke, shooting heroin. They're not going to think, oh, he had one bad night and he took a fucking Xanax. No, they're automatically going to jump to conclusions. More fucking rage and more resentment. But, turns out it would hands down be, looking back now, here we are years later, it would be the best thing that ever could have happened to me. A couple months prior, I reconnected with an old EOD tech buddy of mine. He was over at MARSOC and he was starting up a company and asked me to come aboard. And at the same time, I filled him in, everything was going on. And man, that's fucking bullshit. I'm sorry to hear that. Hey, you know, what are you going to do? So he knew of a job opening on base. So, I interviewed and I got the job. And so my last 2 weeks, I was doing my seps and my separations classes in the morning. And then in the afternoon, I was putting on a button up shirt, you know, with the company logo on it. And I was learning how to be a pyrotechnician on base. I wound up working on base and I was making little simulated IEDs, and the grunts would come through and they would run their drills in these mount towns, and then we would blow them up, you know, it's all safe and controlled. They would react and we would evaluate them and just teach them how to be better. So my piece of the puzzle was I was the bomb maker and I was the button pusher. you know, and then they had former grunts and stuff to kind of hone in on, here's what you messed up, here's what you did wrong, or right and what you did wrong. But the money wasn't, the hours weren't there. So the training wasn't there, which means there was no need for me. So then the money kind of started dwindling off. And then I was like dangerously close to being homeless. And I'm like, oh, fuck, what am I going to do? And then like everything literally it's like the moment that I just kind of let go and just like fell into the universe. The universe is like, hey, bro, I got you. Like, you've dealt with all this shit. Now it's time for me to reciprocate, because I just had this, everything else has just been uphill ever since. I got hit up by an old instructor from one of these courses, one of these like 3-week courses I attended when I was active duty back in like 2010. He's like, oh, hey, I remember you from training. I heard you're out. I have a UXO company. Do you want to jump on a contract? Like, A, what? Like, how did you know I was, holy crap. So yeah. And he's like, it's only a short contract, you know, pays really well. I'm like, yes, let's do it. I'm like, okay, cool. So now I know what I'm going to do for the next month. I'm going to go make a shit ton of money. I looked at my DD-214. I'm like, I'm not going to be that guy. I'm not going to be known for abusing drugs. It's not who I'm going to be. I'm going to be the old Tyler. I'm going to be the guy that said, you will become an EOD tech. Like everything I fucking, when I knuckled down and I said, I'm going to do that, I rose to the occasion and I did it, you know? And it wasn't always the case. There were many things. I wish I could go back in time and be like, hey man, be more confident and you'll succeed. I lacked a lot of confidence. But when I knuckled down, I said, I'm going to do it. I fucking did it. So that's the guy I wanted to be again. I wanted to rebuild my life. And this hard work attitude, it paid off. People took notice. To the program manager, hey, I've heard nothing but good things about you from the crew. So it's not my company, but I got a manager in another company and he's a UXO tech. Do you want to go here? It's 4 months. Yeah, I'll do that. So I went there. I did that. Hey, man, the boss. Hey, so this project's done. I'm actually moving here to take over this project. Do you want to come with me? Hell yeah. Let's fucking do it. And that's how I built my UXO career. So I was traveling the country. I was pulling bombs out of the ground, you know, blowing up dud-fired ordnance. I got back to my EOD roots, you know, of like basic demolition, you know, ordnance identification. It was just great. And I get to hang out with veterans. Like most of these people are prior EOD. Most of them are older. None of them know what happened to me. None of them even give a shit. They don't ask. And it was awesome. You know, and during this time, you know, I took this opportunity. I cut that extra out of my life, and I got my divorce papers rolling, and I started trying to get confident, get back out there, maybe I'm not a piece of shit, you know, maybe she thinks I'm a piece of shit, but maybe somebody else out there won't think. And I wasn't overly concerned with dating. I was just really needed to get me back on track. But, and then, so I was doing the UXO, but then I was also jumping back and forth to this pyrotechnic job, you know, blowing guys up at Camp Lejeune. And then I ended up working, some Pendleton contracts. They had a guy that left. So I was working part-time Pendleton, part-time Lejeune. I would go to Hawaii. I would do it in Hawaii, which is always really cool. And then I would come back and I would do UXO contracts. So I did that for a couple years, and then I kind of also rekindled this relationship, this chick that I dated back in EOD school. So even when we broke up, we still kind of stayed friends. She knew I was deployed, you know, she knew what I was doing. We'd email each other every now and again. She wound up getting married. Then we kind of fell out of touch. And then all one day I was like, you know, like, what is she doing? I'm going to hit her up. So we rekindle our friendship, and I was dating another chick at the time who I thought it was a serious relationship. So I literally was just like, you know, I miss talking to her. I miss having her as in my life as a friend. So this email back and forth went on for a while. And then I started getting these weird cryptic emails, you know, and I told her I was divorced. You know, I literally told her everything. I have no reason to hold shit back from this chick at all. And so I was like, yeah, you know, I'm divorced. And then she starts sending me these emails like, you know, like, well, how did you know it was time to get divorced? I'm like, well, like, you know, when your ex is telling you to go knock up some rando chick, you know, and when she's saying she doesn't give a fuck about you and all, I'm like, it's time. So finally I was just like, look, like what's going on? So she spills the beans. She's like, look, I just don't know if I want to be with my husband anymore. I don't know. And I'm like, look, like I tried counseling. It didn't work for me. Maybe it'll work for you. So then it kind of fades. And then the next email is like, oh, hey, so I'm getting divorced. I'm sorry to hear that, you know, she's got two kids and it's like, you know, I get it. It sucks as a kid. You definitely don't, you feel like a failure. You feel like you fucked up in your marriage. Our conversation started to pick up And I'm contracting. This time I'm not in Virginia. So I'm in Virginia and she's still in fucking LA. And so opposite ends of the country. I met a buddy, met a Navy veteran. He's got a nonprofit organization and he takes veterans in and they do all these retreats. And it's not just like one event. It's awesome. Or anyways, doesn't matter. So he's hosting an event out in California. Hey, Tyler, I want you to come out to this event. They got a World War II bomber and two World War II fighters. And it's like, hey, people are going to be giving rides. We're going to raffle. I'm like, fuck yeah, I want to fly in this old plane. Why not? All I know is I'm coming in, you know, flying into Los Angeles and then they're going to shuttle me up. And I was like, all right, cool. So, hey, so since you're divorced and since I'm divorced, I'm actually going to be in LA. Like, do you want to go to this event with me? It's literally only 24 hours. I was in Southern California for a grand total of like 36 hours. And so flew out here on a Saturday morning, flew back on a Sunday night so I could be back at work on Monday. And I told my boss and he's just like, whatever. I land and I text her and, you know, like the whole time, I'm like fucking nervous. Cause again, I told this chick 12 years ago, I want to marry her, you know, and there were still feelings there, but it was like, okay, like, is this like, you know, punk 24-year-old feelings or what's going on? And so I'm texting her and then I see her off in the at baggage claim and she's facing the other way. And then she turns around, she sees me and it was like this dramatic, like this cheesy dramatic, like threw my backpack down and then we're fucking running towards each other. And I give her a hug and I hear some guy in the distance is like, someone's getting laid tonight. And I couldn't help but laugh. And it was just like this surreal moment and all these good memories of us being together and being in EOD school. And I remember how she made me feel and how she treated me. And I was like, okay, like, all right, fine, whatever. This is, of course I have these emotions, you know, this is a fling. So we ended up spending that day and a half together and I flew back and then our conversations just only escalated from there. And then we just started visiting each other back and forth. And it was just this constant back and forth. And then finally it was just like an opportunity came up. I was like, hey, I've got a UXO job that I can take in 29 Palms. And she's like, okay. And I was like, well, after that, so she had moved in with her mother-in-law too. So I was like, after that, I was kind of thinking that maybe I just don't leave California. Maybe I just move in with you. So it's just, fuck it, let's do it. So after the 29 Palms contract ended, I had everything in my Jeep that I could fit. And I left a bunch of my other stuff in Colorado where I was living with a buddy at the time. And then I moved in and we dated for a little bit. And then finally it was just like, fuck this shit. And we got married. I had a family vacation. I bought a fat ass fucking diamond and happily married coming up on 3 years now. And so I finally, after all this shit storm, I finally have kick ass wife and I have two amazing daughters. And I finally just feel like this is why I survived. And it's through just being able to be a family that now that's been my therapy. My therapy's been doing washing fucking little kids socks and shirts and picking up their toys and just all this shit where it's like, man, I wish they'd pick up their own toys. And it's like, you know what? Fuck that shit. I'm glad I got toys to pick up. And that's really what's been helping me. I love them. I love them more than anything else in the world. They make me whole. Full-time husband, full-time father. And I love to remind her. Hey, remember that night that I called you and told you I was going to marry you? I was fucking right. And then she's like, get the fuck out of here. You didn't know. I'm like, yeah. And I always played off like, yeah, I knew in my heart. And anyways, doesn't matter. But so outside of being a husband and a father and just enjoying the ride, you know, that comes with having, you know, two young kids, I work at LAX at Los Angeles Airport. I work for TSA as an explosive specialist. You know, anytime your stuff gets pulled and anytime you trip up any of our explosive detection, that's when they call me. If you ever want to meet me, bring a candle through LAX, you know, in the morning, Monday through Thursday, and I'll be there. Most recently, I started my own business called Inert Mugs, and I took all my love of ordnance and I took my love of explosives, and I basically turned them into tumblers. So I have 14-ounce tumblers and I have 20-ounce tumblers, and everything is based off of some of my favorite pieces of ordnance. And you can get on my website, you can see the designs, and then you can see what I modeled it after. And this is a new business. I'm not even a year in yet. I'm loving it. I'm having a great time doing it. But, you know, I want to educate the public and I want to show people like why explosives are cool. Like that spark that drew me into EOD. You know, because EOD is more than just, yes, some of the worst times of my life. You know, I still still have dreams, you know, you still see the blood, you still see the bodies and some of the worst times of my life were as an EOD tech. But on the flip side, some of the best times of my life been at an EOD tech, and all that shit made me who I am today. So I can't just completely ignore it. And if I can pass that on and I can take my negatives and turn that into a positive, I don't know, maybe some kid out there is going to get on Etsy and or get on my website and see it and be like, hey mom, I want that mug. And then now they get the bug, they get the itch, they get the spark. Now, because I was a kid that I stole gas from my dad's locker. We'd light shit on fire, steal fireworks from his massive stockpile, and me and my brother would be blowing shit up. So it's in my blood. I was destined to blow shit up. And another great turn of events in my life, another way I've turned my life around. So when I came out here, when I moved out of Southern California, I got plugged in with Veterans Legal Institute, offer free legal advice, and I saw that they did discharge upgrades, and I was curious. So I was like, well, you know, I reached out to them. I honestly thought I was a long shot, but hey, I've already heard no a million times. What's one more no going to do to me? Nothing. Right. So, they interviewed me. I pled my case and I threw everything on the table. I said, look, you know, here's everything that I've messed up because I'm not perfect. I made mistakes. Here's my combat experience. And they took it and they ran with it. And this was like a two, and they told me, hey, it's going to be a couple years. And just out of nowhere, I got a phone call and they said, hey, Mr. Grog, I just want to let you know, congratulations. The board has voted and they're upgrading your discharge to full honorable. And then under remarks, it says like Secretary of the Navy Administrative or something like that. The honorable is great. But to me, the best part is now I get to erase that drug abuse. I'm not erasing the event from my life, but now it no longer defines me. You know, anybody, my children, my grandchildren, anybody that stumbles on that piece of paper and reads that and I'm not around to explain it to them would have assumed the worst. Now they look at it. Hey, dad, grandpa, great grandpa got a full honorable. Oh, I wonder what this means. So now I don't have to be scared of my past anymore. And I don't have to let that one fucking line define me. If you're in a similar situation, reach out to Veterans Legal Institute or somebody that's in your area. It's definitely worth it. Last words, if you're taking the time to watch this, I'm sure part of my story resonates with you. I know mine's not unique. I know there's a lot of people struggling out there. My advice, there's no mistake that you can't overcome. Especially if you just stand up and say, raise your hand. Hey, I messed up. There's going to be a lot of people that are going to turn their backs on you, but that's going to show you who your true friends are. Please don't be afraid to reach out to them. If I can piece myself back together, you can definitely piece yourself back together.